And we are in Philippians chapter 4. Surprise, surprise, for those that have been here a while. Getting near the end of this book. Matter of fact, I think we've got about one more week to finish up. This morning we're going to learn about the secret. And before I read our passage, though, I want to tell you about a book by the same title, named The Secret. Let me just read a paragraph, which I think is basically summarizes the message of the book. The author writes, "The earth turns on its orbit for you. The oceans ebb and flow for you. The birds sing for you. The sun rises and it sets for you. The stars come out for you. Every beautiful thing you see, every wondrous thing you experience is all there for you. Take a look around. None of it can exist without you. No matter who you thought you were, now you know the truth of who you really are. You are the master of the universe. You are heir to the kingdom. You are the perfection of life. And now you know the secret." Imagine, this is like the last thing you want junior hires to be told, right? That they are the master of the universe. That's the very last thing you want them to know, want them to think. What, according to this author, is the secret? What is the secret? Essentially, that we are all gods, right? That is the message of the book, that we are all gods. I call it basically just warmed over New Age gobbledygook is essentially what she's offering here. But the line that gets me the most is this one. None of it can exist without you. She's claiming here that we are creators, not that we're just masters of the universe. We are creators. We are sustainers of the universe. We are the perfection of life. Now, the amazing thing about this book is not just how arrogant she is in her words, but that this book has sold over 12 million copies. Over 12 million copies in print. Apparently, when we are told that you are a god, that is the ultimate ego trip. Do you see? And people are willing to pay a lot of money to be told that they are God. Now, if the author were standing here this morning, I would ask her two key questions. One would be, if we are all gods, if we all possess the power to sustain the universe, then how boring is that? Right? I'm God, you're God, the little babies are God. That sounds a little bit boring to me, frankly. The other question I'd ask her is this. If I am a God, if I contain all this power, why do I need to spend $19.99 on her book to tell me that I'm already a God? I should know this, right? I should be wielding my power wherever I go. Now let's get to the real secret in Philippians chapter 4, verse 10. "I rejoice greatly in the Lord that at last you have renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you have been concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. I'm not saying this because I am in need, for I've learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do everything through him who gives me strength." Now, according to this passage, what is the secret? Well, if the secret of the New Age book is that we're all gods, then the secret of this passage, at the very least, is that we aren't gods, there's only one God, and we are not him. Clearly is what he is saying here. Specifically, the secret that we are to learn this morning is that we are to learn the secret of being content. Now, for obvious reasons, this follows after what we've learned the last 3 weeks, learning about joy and peace in the absence of worry. That contentment goes hand in hand, does it not with that? That we cannot possibly be content if we don't also have joy and peace. And we can't possibly have joy and peace if we don't have a certain level of contentment. First principle this morning is that contentment must be learned. Contentment must be learned. Paul wrote, "I have learned the secret of being content." Now, this isn't the kind of secret you get by flipping through the pages of a book and suddenly you learn it. This is not the kind of secret where someone comes up to you and whispers in your ear, "Hey, listen, I got a secret I want to tell you." This is not the kind of secret where someone just reveals it to you and you instantly know it and possess it. This kind of secret must be learned. You must learn it through experience. But it can't come only through experience. For example, you would think that if someone who grew up during the Great Depression would have learned the secret of contentment, right? They lived without for so long, and certainly they would have learned the secret of contentment. Let's say you are having a conversation with somebody who grew up during the Great Depression, and you're talking about our current economic crisis. And you are maybe complaining about the cost of food. You mentioned that you can't afford to buy that new computer that you've been wanting. And that person stops and says, "Now listen here. You have no idea what it's like to be poor. We were hungry most every day. We could not afford to give medicine to my 7-year-old sister, and she died because of that. My poor father worked himself into a grave just to put food on the table. You have no idea what it means to be poor." Now, if you had such a conversation like that with somebody, would you say this person has learned the secret of being content? Maybe, maybe not. But just because they've experienced poverty doesn't necessarily mean they've learned anything at all. Many people who have experienced severe poverty have learned how to worry, certainly, but they haven't necessarily learned what contentment is. Now they scrimp and they save and they go without, not because they're content, not because they're content to go without, because they're scared to death what's going to happen if they don't have a little bit extra, because they lived it, they experienced it. That is not contentment. They have learned maybe to survive. They've learned, again, how to worry, but they've not necessarily learned the secret of being content. Let's look a little closer at Paul's secret of contentment. "I have learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. I've learned what it is to be in need. I've learned what it is to have plenty." Paul knew how to be content with plenty, and we think, well, that's easy, right? You got plenty? I mean, if I had plenty, I would be content. But think about it for a minute. What did Paul's plenty look like? What was plenty to a first century Christian? Is it he had a nice house on the Mediterranean and a 2-horse stable? He had large stores of food saved up. He had a large supply of gold coins stuck away in a cave somewhere for the future. Is that what plenty looked like? I don't think so. I think for Paul, plenty meant he had enough for that very day. You see, if his stomach was filled by the end of the day, then for Paul, that was plenty. And if his stomach was empty, then it was not enough. If he had more than enough food that he'd eat for that day, he had plenty. So we need to understand that Paul's plenty was not our prosperity. Let's not overlay what we think plenty with what Paul was saying. So what then do you think Paul's need looked like? Was it that he had a house but only a 1-horse stable? He had just a small amount of food. He just had a few gold coins for the future. I don't think so. If his plenty was having more than enough for that day, I think his need was having not enough for that day. He gets to the end of the day and his stomach is a growling and there's no possible way that he's eaten a sufficient amount of food for that day. That, I think, was Paul's need. In case there's any doubt at all that Paul had great needs, that his needs did not look, for the most part, what our needs look like, let me read to you from 2 Corinthians chapter 11, a long list of Paul's needs throughout his life. He said, "I've worked much harder, been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely, been exposed to death again and again." And see, that's enough. All right, he's already topped me by far, but this is a long list. 5 times I received from the Jews 40 lashes minus 1. That's enough just to bring you to the edge of death. 5 times. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. Think about that for a minute. There are Hollywood movies about such things. These are things of nightmares. I mean, who hasn't dreamed of drowning at some point? A night and a day in the open sea. That alone is enough to qualify for an awful life, difficult life. I've been constantly on the move. I've been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my own countrymen, in danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea. You get the idea here, what his life was like. And in danger from false brothers. I have labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I have been cold and naked. Besides everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for all the churches. Who is weak and I do not feel weak? Who is led into sin and I do not inwardly burn? That is a list of needs. And I think that is what he meant when he says, I know what it means. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every circumstances, including all of these circumstances. Now, do you think a guy like Paul, with all these great needs, do you think he ever prayed for what he would call plenty? Do you think he would pray to have more than enough or sufficient enough for that day? I'm guessing he did. And if he did pray, I think he would have prayed a prayer similar to Proverbs 30. Give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, who is the Lord? Or I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of my God. Yet I think Paul prayed just like Jesus taught us to do. Pray for our daily bread. Now, if he had a little more than his daily bread, he was what? Content. If he had a little less than his daily bread, he was what? He was content. He was content in any and every situation. Now, it's interesting that the Greek word for contentment literally means self-rule. Self-rule. Not at all what we tend to think it means. Seneca was a Roman advisor to Emperor Nero, and he wrote this about contentment. He said, "The happy man is content with his present lot, no matter what it is, and is reconciled to his circumstances." What's that sound like? Sounds a little bit like what Paul wrote, doesn't it? Very similar in its words to what Paul wrote. Seneca and others like him, any of Paul's Greek and Roman contemporaries, would have been a proponent of what's called the Stoic doctrine. And here's an example of the Stoic doctrine. That man should be sufficient unto himself for all things and able by the power of his own will to resist the force of his circumstances. Do you see? Contentment was defined as self-rule, as self-sufficiency. So if someone could depend upon themselves and persevere no matter what the circumstances, you would say that person was content. They had learned the secret of being content. Now, most of the people who talk about contentment in our day are using this same definition. Do you see? They're using the same very definition. Let me ask you a question. Is it possible to have contentment without God? Is it possible to have contentment without God? I'm seeing a few north and south. Yes, I think it is. And I agree with you. I think it is possible, at least to some degree, to be what we would call content apart from God. And I think this is what Seneca is describing here. And I think we all know people like this, don't we? People who are not believers, who yet they live in such a way as to be basically free from worry. They seem happy in their circumstances. And if we could look at their lives very closely and examine it and kind of take it apart, I think we'd say, that's contentment. They seem very content and happy. Now, I don't think that's easy to be content without God. I don't think it's very common, but apparently it's possible to achieve this kind of self-rule, this kind of self-sufficiency where you are basically in control of your emotions, where you've learned this positive attitude in all things, kind of like the book, The Secret, that we already looked at. Someone who believes that they are the master of the universe, that the world revolves around them, that it's all about them. And if you tell yourself that long enough, what? You're going to begin to believe it. Eventually, you're going to believe it. Such people have taught themselves to be content with what? Themselves, essentially, with themselves, their circumstances. But is this the kind of contentment that Paul is referring to? Now, if you were to read just verses 10 through 12, I think it sounds a lot like what Seneca, what the Stoics are writing. If you took it out of context, If you read it, especially in that first century context, you would say, yes, that's what he's talking about. He's talking about self-sufficiency. He's talking about self-rule. But Paul did not end with verse 12. He added verse 13. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. Now, it's this one verse. It's this one verse that changes everything. It takes that Stoic doctrine of self-rule and self-sufficiency, radically changes it into a Christ sufficiency. That is what contentment is, a Christ sufficiency. Now, this verse, well known. How many people, raise your hand high, if you don't have to have it memorized now, but you've memorized this at some point in your Christian life. How many people have memorized it? Aha. I won't ask for a raise of hands, but I would guess there's probably at least 10 people in this room to whom this is their life verse, right? I can do everything through Christ. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. Many versions. I don't know which one you memorized. Many of us, this is so much our life verse. But the problem is this. Most Christians do not understand this verse. Most Christians have made this their life verse, and they're using it completely the wrong way. This is what it's often used. It's often morphed into a kind of self-help verse. You know, if I'm struggling with a challenging task at work, well, what? Philippians 4:13. I can do everything through Christ who gives me strength. Christ can give me the strength, and I can tackle this difficult challenge at work. If I'm struggling kind of as a parent, and I need the strength of God, what? Philippians 4:13. I can do everything through Christ who gives me strength. You see? Jesus and me against the world. If I just get Jesus on my side, if I just get him to give me the strength, then I can do almost anything. And I submit to you, I'm guessing this is the average and typical understanding of this verse. It's Jesus and me against the world. And if he's given me strength, I can do all things, which literally means almost anything to us. But I do not think this is what Paul meant. If Christ gives me strength, I can do almost anything. Now, I believe that's true. Don't get me wrong. I believe that Christ, obviously, God gives us the power to do this challenging task. God gives us the power to be a better parent. God gives us the power to do whatever it is he asks us to do. No question about that. But I'm saying I don't think this is exactly what this verse means. I think what it means is it means that with Christ, I don't need anything. You see, it's the opposite of this self-rule, this self-sufficiency. It is Christ sufficiency. Now, if I have daily bread, I am content. Why? Not because I have the daily bread, but because I have Christ. And if I don't have my daily bread, I'm still content. Why? Because I have Christ. That Christ sufficiency is what Paul is talking about here. This past Wednesday, I had breakfast with Ray Olson. For those of you who don't know Ray, he is the director of church planning for our district of Wisconsin. And we had breakfast together and with Pastor Jose Reyes. He's a Latino church planner in Norwalk. And we enjoyed breakfast together. And I didn't really know Jose that well. He's been down. Maybe some of you saw him working on our building a couple of weekends this past fall. And Ray had to get going, and I was intrigued by some things Jose was talking about his background. So I asked, could he stay for a while? We ended up talking like an hour and a half afterwards, just getting to know Jose much better. He was telling me about his very, very difficult background in El Salvador. Grew up in the poorest of poor neighborhoods. He said, picture the poorest neighborhood you've ever seen. Now, for me, that was a literally dirt-poor neighborhood in Guatemala. He said, poorest of the poor neighborhood, that was us. My single mother would often go without food just to feed our three children. You get the picture. Terrible situation. Well, he's now in the United States. I mean, obviously he's now, but the story he's telling, he's in the United States for a few years. He and his wife going to purchase a bed from another Latino friend who is moving out of the area. I think he was kind of running from immigration and is getting rid of a bunch of his stuff. So they go and they're buying a bed. Now, in the process of buying this bed, he and his wife are there, and I think they already paid for it, and they felt convicted. They felt led by the Lord, they're believers by this time, to give this bed to to this single mother that they know who is sleeping on the floor with her little baby. So they think, oh man, God obviously wants us to give this bed to the single mom so they don't have to sleep on the floor. So they get help and they don't have a truck and they go through this long process getting the bed delivered to the single mom. I don't think she's a believer, so she's just overcome with joy and she doesn't have to sleep on the floor anymore. She's so moved by that. Jose and his wife drive home, go to unlock the door to their small little apartment, and Jose says, he just starts laughing. He's just laughing and laughing and laughing. And of course, his wife's standing next to him. What's going on? Jose, why are you laughing? And he says, I just realized we're going to spend another night sleeping on the floor. It was their bed. This wasn't a bed for their spare bedroom. This was not a guest bed. They were sleeping on the floor. They gave away their bed. And here's the surprising thing. It's almost unbelievable, but I have to believe it's true. He told me that whole time he's delivering the bed for that single mom, he did not think once that he was going to be sleeping on the floor that night. Somehow God protected him from that. And apparently his wife didn't either. At least she didn't mention it. She was completely for this. Amazing story. I would say, now that is what? That's contentment. I believe that's a kind of contentment that most of us will probably never know because we're not in those kind of situations. But the kind of contentment that Paul is talking about is so much more than just contentment in material things. I mean, we could come up with story after story about not having beds and sleeping on the floor, etc. But it's so much more than just that. If your friends turn their back on you, stab you in the back, whatever it is you want to call it, can you still have contentment? Is Christ sufficient? If your husband or wife wakes up one morning and says, I don't want to be with you anymore, I don't want to be married to you, can you still have contentment? If you lose somebody that you dearly, dearly love, can you still have contentment? That's the answer. That's the question. Now, those things will hurt terribly. You will grieve. You will feel pain. You will mourn. But in the end of the day, do you say, is Christ sufficient in my times of need? Or is he not? And remember, contentment is something that's learned over time. We learn it through experiencing the sufficiency of Christ in our time of need. And that's essentially the steps we go through, isn't it? We have a need. That's the easy part, isn't it? Having needs. We just stumble into needs. You have a need. You experience the sufficiency of Christ in that need. And then what? You got to learn a lesson from it. It's not just going through hard times, as I said before. It's not just a matter of surviving the needs. But it's experiencing the sufficiency of Christ and then learning and remembering, look, Christ was sufficient and he will be again. That's a process of learning to be content in any and every situation. Now, there is a whole lot of other biblical principles, a whole lot of theology that's underlying this contentment. I could spend a long time on that. Let me just give you several principles to end here about, theological principles that underlie what Paul is talking about here. Number one, God is sovereign over all things. Now, this reminds us that we are not masters of the universe, right? That there's one God, and you and I are not him. Number two, God always has our best interest at heart. But the problem is, number three, God's best interest toward me is not always what I think it ought to be. That's something to remember in our time of contentment. Next, the best and highest gift that God can give me is himself. And I know if you've listened to me before, you know I talk about this a lot. But that salvation, sometimes we turn it into this inanimate gift. We say, I am saved. I'm saved from hell. I'm going to heaven. Good. Wonderful. Rejoice in that. But the greatest part about salvation is not going to heaven. It's not escaping hell. It is knowing Christ. It is having God as the ultimate gift himself. And that changes no matter what. Do you see? That is the in every circumstance. Christ cannot change in that. Next, related to that, this life is not as good as it gets. We understand it's only an echo of eternity, right? That's the only thing that can allow us to let go of these things. in life is to realize this is not as good as it gets. Lastly, I want to emphasize, having needs is part of discipleship. Do you see? If I am to experience the sufficiency of Christ in my time of need, it requires I have a time of need. So when you have those times of needs, understand this is discipleship. A disciple is a learner. You are there to learn the secret of being content. You're not there to complain about not having what you want or just to survive this time of need. You are in that need to learn the secret of being content. You want that? Oh, I want that so much. So much. We are now going to celebrate together in the Lord's Supper. And I encourage you, as we do that, I'll dismiss you in a minute and we'll take the elements. But as you approach the table, I encourage you to think about the sufficiency of Christ. As you think about the sacrifice of Christ, the cross, you approach the table and say, ask yourself this question, is Christ sufficient right now? If I lose, fill in the blank. If I have to go without, fill in the blank. Is Christ sufficient right now? That's a question I want you to ask. Let me just instruct you for our visitors. We practice what we call open communion. So if you are certain that the Lord has saved you, that is the Lord of your life, we invite you to share in the Lord's Supper with us. Please go down both sides of the table. Take the elements, have a seat again, and then we'll partake together. Thank you. That song went beautifully with the message you hear. You give and taketh away. And is Christ sufficient in those times? The Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took the bread. And after he gave thanks, he broke it and said, "This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, after the supper, he took the cup, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink of it in remembrance of me." And the Apostle Paul adds, "Whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes."